The Guardian.
Hi, Nicola Davis here. Before you get started with this edition of Science Weekly, we want to point you in the direction of our sponsor, Squarespace. For everything you need to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian to get 10% off your first purchase. And now, on with the show. The ability to learn language is arguably one of humanity's most remarkable and important feats. But just how hardwired are we when it comes to learning this valuable trait?
Where are we going to go? In here?
To explore this, producer Max went to meet Adam.
So, to start off, could you just introduce yourself? Who are you and what do you do?
I'm Adam. I'm currently working as a menswear designer. That's about it, really.
Adam was also born deaf.
They didn't know until I was 2 years old, and so they had absolutely no clue throughout my entire childhood. And then when I was 2 years old, they moved back to England from the Philippines, where we've been living. And I think my grandmother noticed that I wasn't responding, and I think I just took it from there, and I was tested, and they found out I was deaf. And so at the age of 2, I was fitted with hearing aid.
And so they had no idea?
Not at all.
When you were, no inclination, nothing?
No.
And so, growing up in the Philippines, was there anything about their culture that allowed you to maybe pick up on language?
Absolutely. The first thing was that babies are always with the mother, always carried. And so I'd either be like on her hip or I would be tied to her chest with fabric. And I'd already started to speak and say some words, even though I had at that point no hearing aid, no hearing, through the vibration that I felt in her chest. And my mum says in hindsight, she now realises that as a child, my hand was always on her neck. And it wasn't until years later that she realised that that would have been maybe how I'd learned. Also, as well, the culture there isn't that the baby's left lying down. It's very much like you're picked up, you're played with, very loud, very in your face. And we had two domestic staff working for us there. And so whenever my mum wasn't playing with me, they were. So looking back, I probably had a lot more stimulation from that.
And so it was the tactile sort of stimulation.
Yeah.
Feeling people breathe, essentially.
Yeah. I noticed this feeling in the throat, though. My mum would shout to my brother, "Stuart, come here, now it's time for food." And I would repeat what she said with my hand in her throat. And at that point, already talking, it never occurred to her that I might have a hearing loss. And another thing I had was the two little, a very, very 80s toys, plastic sunflowers. And then when you spoke to it, it would dawn. And so I would have that on the shelf by my cot, and I would make noise and the thing would dawn. So I think obviously very early on I learned that, you know, when you made a noise, you got a reaction back from it.
Moving back to the United Kingdom from the Philippines, Adam is now able to lip read. So well, in fact, he can distinguish accents and speak not just English, but also French. According to Adam, it's all down to his early experiences.
I would say comparatively, like compared to most deaf people, it was pretty much on par with hearing people. I think that is just down to the unusual experience that I had as a baby. Because there's also a window of time where if you don't stimulate the learning of language within the first 2 years, and funnily enough, it was those 2 years where I got the hearing aid, it could have gone catastrophically wrong. I could have had massively impaired speech and language. So I was very lucky. And I think that unusual setup that I had massively contributed to that.
Rewind to the mid-1960s, and war broke out following a mutiny. It wasn't a war of guns and violence, though. It was a war of words, literally.
In advance of experience, the child is already equipped with an understanding of the basic structure of any human language.
This was the linguistic wars. On one side was the world-renowned MIT professor of linguistics, Noam Chomsky.
Core to language.
linguists have come to use the term universal grammar.
And on the other, a group of his former students, including Professor Paul Lakoff, now at the University of California, Berkeley. Part of the debate involved Chomsky's concept of a universal grammar, which proposes a system of categories, mechanisms, and constraints shared by all human languages and are considered to be innate.
Language sets us apart. Other animals communicate, but they don't have anything approaching the sophisticated grammar of human languages.
Importantly, Chomsky's point was that humans were born endowed with access to knowledge of this universal grammar, breeding a schism that remains to this day. But what are the main objections? And what evidence, if any, is there for either side? I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.
The mind is a blank slate on which experience writes.
So where better to start than a simple definition?
Hi.
This is Professor Ben Ambridge.
My name is Ben Ambridge, and I'm a reader in psychology at the University of Liverpool and the ESRC International Centre for Language and Communicative Development.
We spoke to Ben via Skype and started by asking him what people mean when they talk about universal grammar, or UG.
I think what makes this whole question difficult is that people combine a lot of different things into UG, and I think there are three main things. So firstly, people mean just the ability to learn language. And I think we could all agree with that. There's certainly something innate or something genetic, which means humans can learn language in a way that, like, a dog or a cat, for example, can't do. Another thing that people sometimes mean by universal grammar is the fact that all languages seem to have certain things in common. And again, I think most people would agree with that. I certainly would. So, for example, all languages have something like a noun or a noun phrase, some way of, or some part of speech that refers to, like, a person, a place, a concept, or whatever. So I think most people would agree that languages seem to have at least some things in common. When it gets more controversial is when we come on to the third thing, which is specific linguistic knowledge. So this is the idea that we're born, for example, with empty categories like verb and noun, and born with some basic rules for combining them together to form different types of sentences. And that's where I would disagree with the idea of universal grammar.
In this way, Ben makes a clear distinction between being born with the ability to learn language and being born with the knowledge of language itself.
So as an analogy, we're all born with the ability to learn to play chess or the ability to learn to play football, but we're not born with actual knowledge of chess or knowledge of football, just with general abilities that let us learn them. So I'd say in the same way, we're born with the ability to learn language, but that's not the same as being born with knowledge of language.
It would seem that it's this third and final point that drives the divide in the world of linguistics. But not everyone would agree with Ben's point of view. Producer Max went to speak to one such person.
Dan Everett has claimed that it's not for a language called Purahan, and we can come back to that because his arguments don't go through for all sorts of interesting reasons.
This is Neil Smith, Emeritus Professor at University College London's Department of Phonetics and Linguistics.
The standard generative, by which I'm referring partly to Chomsky but also to other people's work.
Neil started by telling us that UG includes rules which apply to all languages. Two of these are called principles and parameters.
Principles are things which are universally true for every language but may have subtly different interpretations, and parameters refers to the full range of possible variation between languages. But they're all committed in some sense to the fact that the principles and maybe some of the parametric choices are available from the beginning. It's a sense in which they must be innate.
The exact nature of this innateness is something we will return to shortly. But before we do, what are some examples of these principles and parameters?
The most famous principle, and the one which is quite easy to illustrate, is one that's called structure dependence. All rules in all languages, syntactic rules, phonological rules, morphological rules, semantic rules in all languages are defined over structure, not over a simple linear sequence 1, 2, 3, 4. So Another way of putting that is that rules of grammar can't count. And rules of grammar can't be such that they instantiate simple mathematical operations like inversion. So you can say something like, John ran away. You can invert that and say, away ran John. But that's not the correct description of the rule. And there's no rule that simply inverts the order of words. And you can demonstrate that by saying, the boy ran away, away ran boy the. So if you simply invert it, as a mathematician or self-respecting Martian would be able to, then you get garbage. So a principle is that in all cases, rules are structure dependent. Parameters refers to all those dimensions along which languages can differ from each other. And supposing you want to know, what do you have to know to speak English or to know English? Well, you know that if someone says to you, I speak fluently English, they don't really speak English fluently, because English people say, I speak fluent English or I speak English fluently, but you can't say, I speak fluently English. That's just a fact about English grammar. Translate that into French. Je parle couramment l'anglais. Is that well formed? It's fine. So French has a different word order to English. That's a parametric difference. And then the question is, how do we account for that parametric difference? And in order to learn that difference, it clearly can't be an innate property, because it's different from English and French, and children aren't born with a tendency to learn one rather than the other. So there has to be some way that that can be evidenced in the input signal. And to get that evidence, you have to have sentences with adverbs in them, and so on and so forth.
In this way, Neil would subscribe to Chomsky's idea that, if aliens were to come to Earth, they would deem all languages to be dialects of a single universal language. Importantly, Neil believes UG points to innate systems which allow us to access this UG and thus acquire language in all its forms. But Ben believes there might be another explanation for the shared characteristics of languages.
Well, if we think about what are the structural aspects that most or maybe all languages share. So one, I already mentioned the idea that we have some sort of noun phrase, things that can refer to a person or thing or a concept. Another thing that probably all languages have in common is some way of indicating when an action or event is done by one person alone, as opposed to when it's done by one person to another, or a way of marking who caused an event and so on. And I'd say that where we have a structure that most languages have, the reason why different languages have ways of doing this is because we're all humans and we all want to get across similar types of ideas. So I'd say it's more cognitive universals leading to the linguistics universals rather than just being born with linguistics universals.
Another argument that is often used against innate knowledge of UG is known as evolutionary plausibility.
So the idea here is that parts of universal grammar that you would need to be born with, the argument is that they wouldn't necessarily help in evolution. They wouldn't make you evolutionarily fitter. So an example is something called subjacency. So it's fine to ask as a question, what did John read a book about? But it's not fine to say, what did John read a book that was about? Even though you can kind of get what I mean by that, it's not grammatical. We just can't say it. From a universal grammar perspective, some people would argue that the reason you can't say this is that we're born with some knowledge that rules out this type of sentence. But for me, this isn't evolutionarily plausible, because I don't see how having a bias against producing this type of sentence is, you know, to put it bluntly, going to make you more likely to successfully reproduce. And secondly, although, you know, I'm not a geneticist, don't have any kind of detailed knowledge of biology, it seems to me a big stretch to argue that a very abstract linguistic constraint against a particular sentence type is even the types of things that genes encode for, as opposed to more common physical or psychological characteristics.
While it's all well and good to point out the potential flaws of UG, what are the alternative theories?
Constructivism says, yes, we're born with the desire and the ability to learn language, but not with any specific knowledge of how language works per se.
And what evidence, if any, can either side of the UG debate present?
Now that constitutes, I would contend, prima facie evidence in favour of universal grammar.
All coming up after this short break.
Hi, Ian Sample here. This episode of Science Weekly is sponsored by Squarespace. To find out more about how to set your website apart, head to squarespace.com/guardian.
Before we kick off again, I want to recommend another one of our podcasts here at The Guardian. It's called Audio Long Reads and contains some of The Guardian's best journalism in the form of long read articles from the paper. Recent long reads include Ewan McGaskill and Jonathan Franklin's portrait of Roberto Kozak, Latin America's Schindler, and Tom Lamont's piece on the dangerous world of British betting shops. To subscribe to Audio Long Reads, head to theguardian.com/podcasts or get it on your favourite podcast app. Welcome back to Science Weekly. I'm Nicola Davis. Before the break, we heard Adam's incredible story of language acquisition despite what MIT linguist Noam Chomsky once called a poverty of stimulus, something Professor Neil Smith would describe to Chomsky's concept of universal grammar, an innate ability to access universal principles and parameters during early language development.
In advance of experience, the child is already equipped with an understanding of the basic structure of any human language.
But not everyone is on board, and other ideas exist. As explained by Professor Ben Ambridge, one of these is known as constructivism.
Constructivism says, yes, we're born with the desire and the ability to learn language, but not with any specific knowledge of how language works per se. So I'll give you an example. In English, we have to say kick the ball. The verb kick comes first. But in Turkish, you have to say the ball kick. So the verb comes last. So the universal grammar account would be that we're born with a switch, which you have to set to essentially verb first or verb last on the basis of the language around you. Whereas the constructivist explanation of that would be that we just learn gradually that, for example, in English, kickers come before what gets kicked. Then we generalise from that up to, more generally, the action comes before the thing that has the action done to it, and so on.
But are there testable predictions for this approach?
Another central constructivist idea is the idea of slot and frame patterns. So this would be, for example, imagine that a kid hears, I'm kicking it, I'm throwing it, I'm eating it, and so on. So the idea is that the child, having stored those sentences, would make an analogy across them to get I'm actioning it slot and frame pattern. And the idea is then she can slot in any action word that she knows into that I'm actioning it pattern to produce a new sentence. So the prediction that follows on from that is that children should be better at producing sentences when they have one of these slot and frame patterns stored than when they can't. And there's been quite a lot of studies that have tested that idea, both in lab studies, getting kids to sort of produce different sentences under laboratory conditions, or just recording them in a spontaneous conversation at home. And for me, the evidence from those studies backs up that prediction.
It would seem that constructivism poses a substantial challenge to Chomsky's UG. That said, constructivism isn't the only approach with experimental backing.
And one of the things we did was test this idea that rules of grammar can't count. We did it on the basis of experiments with an autistic savant on whom I worked for 20 years or so. This is a man called Christopher. He's institutionalized because he can't look after himself. Noughts and crosses is beyond his intellectual ability. He wouldn't find his way out of this room. but he can read, speak, write, understand and translate between 20 languages. What we did was try and find out if we could suss out precisely what Christopher's phenomenal language learning ability consisted in. So in order to do this, we taught him some new languages, three new languages altogether. One new language that we taught him was Berber, which is a North African language with an extremely complicated morphology and which he took to like a duck to water. Another language that we taught him much later was British Sign Language, which we can come back to. The one that's more interesting at the moment is that we taught him a language that we called Epun, E-P-U-N. And we taught it to him over a period of a year, and we told him that it was a language spoken somewhere or other. And this language started out as being perfectly normal language. It had subject, verb, object, word order. It had a rich morphology, that is all sorts of affixal endings and prefixes and so on. But after 6 months, we began to introduce processes that were impossible, according to universal grammar, were impossible to find in any language. So one of these was that in order to form emphatic sentences, you add an affix to the third word in the sentence. I said that languages can't have rules that count, so this was an example. We taught this language to Christopher and a group of undergraduates. The hypothesis was that because of his phenomenal language ability, Christopher would be able to cope with anything that was overt in the morphology, but would be completely floored by this third word possibility, because that doesn't occur in any language. On the other hand, we predicted that the undergraduates, because of their intelligence, would simply treat it as a puzzle and would come up with the correct answer. So we ran the experiment. It took a lot of work, long time.
To invent a language, didn't he?
Well, I invented the language and had to invent vocabulary and so on. The results were even more interesting than we expected. The first hypothesis was correct. Christopher failed to learn how to place this emphatic affix in third place. But the undergraduates all failed as well. So when it comes to solving a problem, the undergraduates could do it quite easily. But in a linguistic environment, even the undergraduates never thought that they could use a counting strategy, because it's so deeply ingrained in the human mentation or the human cognitive system that languages aren't like that, that not a single one of the undergraduate controls came up with a solution. Now that constitutes, I would contend, prima facie evidence in favor of universal grammar, or indeed any variant on universal grammar that has the same prediction, namely that languages can't count, or the rules of language can't count.
But with this example, we hit on a key aspect of the UG debate, which comes down to the fundamental level of whether we're born with innate knowledge of these linguistic principles or acquire them through exposure, something that's hard to pick apart in fully developed adults, autistic or not. With this in mind, is there any overlap between the likes of UG and constructivism?
One area in which the two different approaches are maybe coming together is there could be things that we're born with that are not exactly linguistic, but that are kind of like ways of seeing the world that map onto common linguistic categories. So I talk, for example, about all languages seem to have a way of kind of getting across who did what to whom, who caused an event and who had that event happen to them. So you could kind of imagine a coming together of the two theories where you might not be born with a linguistic knowledge of that, but we're born with the kind of bias to parse the world in a certain way, to sort of interpret the world in terms of, you know, actors doing things on other people. And then that wouldn't be a linguistic bias per se, but that would explain some of the linguistic biases that we do see in language.
And even though Ben feels UG is something that needs to now be moved past, he points out the importance of having such theories.
I think in any scientific field, it's important to have big, bold theories, because without theories, science is just stamp collecting. You know, this happens, that happens, something else happens. What's important is what that says about a theory. So say a kid says, for example, bringed instead of brought. Now, on its own, that's, you know, it might be cute, it might be interesting, but that observation on its own isn't science. When it starts to become science is when you start to come up with a theory of why the kid said bringed, and not just why the kid said bring, but why the kid doesn't make that similar mistake for other types of verbs. And then when it really becomes science is when you link that into a wider theory of what that tells us more generally about how children learn language.
So whether it's Chomsky's innateness of universal grammar, or more the exposure-driven likes of constructivism, the debate rages on. But with each new insight, we shed more light on humankind.
And then just to finish up, there was this really nice quote in Reflections on Language by Chomsky.
75.
And he says, one reason for studying language, and for me personally the most compelling reason, is that it is tempting to regard language in the traditional phrase as a mirror of the mind.
Yeah. Yeah, I used that as the epigraph to a book on Chomsky I wrote a long time ago. And it depends what one means by mind. Clearly, the structure of natural languages is not particularly similar to the structure of vision or to the structure of encyclopedic memory, which again differs from person to person in all sorts of interesting ways, but that it gives you insight into what is extremely important and for many people the most important aspect of our being, there's no doubt. You can't get far without language. And if you want to profess your love for someone or find out how to cook a breakfast, you need to use your language, or you take an awful long time and do it very badly.
I mentioned before the idea that probably all languages have a way of marking who did an action, who had it done to them. So presumably this is something that humans care about. So the things that languages do and don't seem to care about, that are and are not kind of particularly marked in language, I think is a good indicator of what humans as a species kind of find important. You know, so that makes sense in evolutionary terms. Why do we care about who caused an action or who caused a particular state? You can understand that in terms of evolution. If John goes around causing people to become dead or people become injured, then, you know, you need to know about that. You probably want to stay away from him. So humans care about causes and causes, so it makes sense that languages would have common ways of marking causes and causes as well. So I think language can give a window on what humans as a species are concerned about.
Special thanks this week to Adam Watson, Ben Ambridge and Neil Smith. I'm Nicola Davis. This is Science Weekly.